last thing I see is feeling, and I'm telling you, I'm a fake. That's the used. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus, the Toronto Blue Jays. Not exactly passing this litmus test series so far. They lose 10-1 to the Baltimore Orioles yesterday. There is a lot of nitpicking we can do with how the bullpen day was rolled out, how it was executed. There's a lot of nitpicking you can do with the way certain curveballs were hung to certain Blue Jays killers who then killed those hung curveballs and killed the Blue Jays again. There's a lot of nitpicking you can do about a franchise record 26th consecutive game with no first inning run. We are now five off of the all-time major league record first inning scoring drought. Mark your calendars for later this weekend. We can nitpick a lot of that stuff, but the high-level item here after two games with the Orioles is the same high level item we've been talking about coming out of tough weekend series on Mondays, coming out of Ross Atkins' last media availability, coming out of the last time the Blue Jays had a hard stretch of schedule. The Blue Jays just don't seem to measure up to the good teams in baseball. It's great that they went 7-2 against the White Sox and the Pirates. That's what you're supposed to do. That kind of floated you back toward 500 and made June a month worth keeping eyes on. But they've had two chances here to play against a team that is an actual quality baseball team. A team that, by the way, is very, very good and not even the best team in the division, both by record and I think if you looked at it on paper and just how you feel about these teams moving forward. So this isn't even the like absolute class of the American League and the absolute class of the entire Major League Baseball. You're going to see more of those teams this month. You got the Yankees here later this month. You're going to play six against Cleveland, who lead their division and have a record on par with the Orioles. You're going to see the division-leading Brewers. You are going to see a lot more of these teams than you are going to see teams like the Oakland Athletics on the weekend. And maybe they sweep the A's. Cool. Nice to go into Oakland for your final visit there before you're visiting, basically Christie Pitts, Sacramento in future years. But right now, every time the Blue Jays play good competition, they don't look in the same class. Let's break it down with Ben Nicholson-Smith. He's in studio with us for the hour. Good morning, man. Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure. How's it going today?
It's okay. It's, the Jays could still split this series. I would prefer my cluster luck and sequencing luck to not have two really, really dispiriting losses in a row to start the series coming out of a 5-1 week.
Yeah, they're just not playing well enough. And like you said, they don't seem to measure up against those elite teams. The Jays, at this point, year five of Vladimir Bo, they were supposed to be one of those scary teams for everyone else. And clearly, the Yankees, Orioles, Phillies, Dodgers, there's just a class of teams that is so far beyond where the Blue Jays are. And so you look now at where the Blue Jays are, they're like in the same playoff odds bracket as the Reds and Pirates. Like, it's... That's
cool.
Objectively, right?
That's where they are. At least the Jays have exciting young players like Ellie De La Cruz and Jared Jones and Paul Skeens, right?
Right. O'Neill Cruz. Yeah. Watch out. Yeah. I mean, it's they're not in a good spot. They really aren't. It doesn't look like they're going to be selling this season. So that's what the likelihood is at this point.
Yeah. I'd imagine teams will start helicoptering around pretty soon. Jeff Passan of ESPN reporting yesterday that the Jays are kind of a could go either direction team.
And which we know.
And nobody expects them to be sellers until much closer to the deadline. They're going to, as much as people might want to hit the sell button right now, I would imagine if you gave the Jays the old truth, J.D. Bunkus truth serum experiment, they would say, we don't think we're going to get more for trading guys right now than we are in late July, so we're going to ride it out just in case.
Yeah, there's truly 0 point. I don't think that any baseball executive would say, now is the time, June 5th is the time to sell. It's just no one does it for that reason. Is you can give yourself the month, and then who knows, like maybe there is a small chance that this team just goes off, might seem unlikely to those of us who've watched the last
small
little
chance,
while.
Yeah.
But look, it exists, and you can always sell on July 15th or July 20th. You're going to wait. They're going to wait. They're going to see. And then if things continue on this path, they will be sellers.
Yeah, and that'll be an interesting conversation for the last couple weeks of July coming out of the All-Star break and things like that. We're going to talk some high-level stuff in this hour with you. We've also got Hannah Kaiser coming on at 11 o'clock. We got Trevor May in the second hour as well, pre-taped one with him yesterday. It was a really great chat. We're going to do some of this high-level stuff because it's really hard not to reflect big picture on this era of the Blue Jays in this core when the Baltimore Orioles are doing all the things and more that the Jays were supposed to do, and they're doing it cheaper and they're doing it with a better farm system still behind them and things like that. Let's do a little bit on the game last night though, because don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater kind of thing. There were some, relevant things. It doesn't feel like it when you lose 10-1, like this is one of the issues about playing really bad baseball and getting blown out is, you know, I've always felt this way analyzing basketball too, is like you don't learn very much in a 30-point beatdown. You don't learn as much in a 10-1 game where a team just outclasses you. But there were some interesting decisions that we could talk about. The Jays went with a bullpen day. They got two good innings out of Trevor Richards. I know they got the pitch count up on Richards, so he couldn't go further than that. I guess we should take a moment to appreciate Trevor Richards because he continues to be like the guy who is getting it done bouncing around like this for a second consecutive year. And boy, he was the only bright spot yesterday.
Yeah, two really good innings from him. And then after that, I mean, yeah, Yenesis Cabrera to Bowden Francis. And Francis just continues to look like a guy who, you know, is hittable. And we saw that before he went on the injured list. We saw that against the Orioles. Ryan Mountcastle, the rest of that Orioles team, did a lot of damage against Bowden Francis. So that's not great for yesterday's outcome. It's also a bit worrying going forward if you're the Blue Jays, because that Alec Manoah spot in the rotation is still vacant. There's no one who's just about to jump in and take it. And if you're going to be relying on Francis in an extended role in that spot, then that does create some questions. So, you know, Yariel Rodriguez continues to build up. Maybe he's a solution there. But in the meantime, you need more from Bowden Francis than what he was able to give.
Yeah, absolutely. You need more from him. And, you know, that we can nitpick the decision to bring him in that spot or go to Cabrera first. But, yeah, you leave a curveball where you left it to Ryan Mountcastle, and it's not going to end very well. I guess a side question here is, what is Ryan Mountcastle's problem? Like, what does he have against us and the city and the Toronto Blue Jays?
To me, the Ryan Mountcastle thing is wild, because if you were talking about, like, you know, how the Yankees view the Orioles or how the Red Sox view the Orioles, it's Adley, it's Gunnar Henderson, but they're just so deep that, you know, for the Jays, it's Santander, it's Mountcastle. Obviously, those two guys have absolutely destroyed the Blue Jays, but, you know, you go down the lineup, it's Austin Hayes with a 2-home run game. Like, they are just... This is the thing, when you have Jordan Westbrook hitting sixth, they are such a deep lineup. It's incredible what the Orioles have done.
It is. Okay, so let's nitpick a little bit of how they rolled the bullpen day out, just for the sake of it, because they're going to have more of these bullpen days ahead, and you'd like them to execute it better. You know, the games do still matter, even if you think they're going to sell at this point. So they get two out of Richards, and the way I understand the idea to go to Cabrera next is that if he has a clean inning, that sets up your fourth, fifth, sixth inning pretty well. Bowden Francis is coming into a spot that you like. It's a pretty big if. And I know Yenesis Cabrera was coming off a pretty good outing, but if we look at the totality of what he's done this year and in his career, you know, that if he has a clean inning against the Orioles seemed a little dicey. The idea of an opener and a follower is also that, and this isn't universal, but with someone like Bowden Francis, who you want four innings out of, it is that... by using an opener, he doesn't have to face the top of the order twice. Yeah. If you're facing 12 batters, instead of 1, 2, 3 hitters being the guys you face twice, it's a 7, 8, 9 hitters. So in going to Cabrera next, they kind of punted on that value of the follower. And then even if things had gone well, Bowden Francis's second time through the order, that fourth inning was going to be against the top of the order again. What did you make of that part of the decision? Like, I'm not a big fan of the opener and follower anyway. I know they're doing this out of desperation, but even when teams like the Rays or the Dodgers or Yankees use it and they're using it for like smart reasons, I don't really like it. But if you're going to do it, you got to execute those points well.
Well, yeah, I think so for the Jays today. Yesterday, I really don't see another option as opposed to a bullpen game. So I have no problem with them doing a bullpen game to start. Then how they execute it, I would agree with you. I say that you want to start Bowden Francis against 6, 7, 8, 9, something like that. They had the chance to do that. They didn't take it. So I would agree with you. But then zooming out again, I kind of look at this and I'm just like, someone's got a pitch. And the reality is the Jays do not have a deep bullpen right now. And it's going to get exposed at some point. If it wasn't in the third inning or the fourth, it would have been in the seventh or the eighth, because they just don't have, at a time that Romano is hurt, Swanson's in the minor leagues, they just don't have that depth.
And Swanson got touched up last night too in AAA.
So what was the line?
He gave up a 2-run home run. So he's made 3 appearances down there now. Only 2 earned, like the other 2 were clean, but he gave up a hit and a walk. And yeah, yesterday got to a couple times. I didn't watch it, but I looked at the game day and yeah it was not the best place fastball I've ever seen for a home run down there. So yeah, it's going to, I guess this is the other thing, is that now not only did you lose that game, But when guys give up a lot of runs and they're pitch inefficient, they also, like Bowden Francis gave you 3+ innings. That's fine. Ideally, you would have got another inning out of him and saved the bullpen a little bit. John Schneider said after the game that everyone other than Bowden would be available today. But you have to think like Pearson, Pop, and Richards are yellow now. So not only did you get the break speed off of you yesterday, but you're in a disadvantageous spot here in game 3 of the series. Whereas the Orioles just got 6+ out of Grayson Rodriguez and 7 out of Corbin Burns, barely touched the one weakness that they maybe have, which is a mediocre bullpen. They're fresh as heck.
Yeah, this is where you see all kinds of trickle-down effects from starting pitching. And the Blue Jays had the advantage of that last year when their starting rotation was so good. And it meant that they could, you know, lean on some of those top relievers less, lean on their bullpen less, period. And maybe just throw some innings to some lower leverage guys. That's not the case right now, especially because the rotation, even the healthy guys, haven't performed quite to that level that we saw in 2023. So we're just looking at a weakened pitching staff, which is not good in tandem with an offense that really doesn't hit home runs.
No, a couple John Schneider quotes for you, just because, again, I nitpicked on Twitter as this was happening, you know, call it in the air. I didn't like the way that they rolled things out. But yeah, when Bowden Francis pitches as he does, Cabrera pitches as he does, that stuff doesn't really matter all that much. But John Schneider said after the game, you have to execute. We felt good about the plan going in. It's up to the players to go out there and execute the pitches. If you don't, that's what happens. If you're throwing expletive in the middle of the zone and hoping for a good result, it's probably not going to happen against Ryan Mountcastle or against me. So pretty strong words there from Schneider. We've noticed the shift in that tone, yeah. You know, directing things more toward, hey, we can prep these guys, we can plan, we can change the evaluative scorecards that Shai Davidi wrote about, but these guys got to get it done.
Right. And even with Corbin Burns in John Schneider's post-game comments, you know, he wasn't just saying, hey, tip your cap.
He's out
right?
of caps the tip.
He's out of caps the tip. And to be honest, to be totally fair, you actually could tip your cap to Corbin Burns last night. I know no one wants to hear it, but the dude is throwing 99. Like, he's a Cy Young winner. That's actually probably one of those times. But good for John Schneider to kind of realize this is not what anyone wants to hear. And look, it's also true. Like, at a certain point, if you want to gain ground in the American League East, you have to beat the best. And the Blue Jays are not hanging with the best teams. I mean, that's just putting it mildly. They have so much distance to overcome. And it's as much as, you know, you and I look at this and it's objectively unlikely, right, that they're going to make the playoffs. And that's a fact. Within that clubhouse, they kind of have to ignore that, push that aside, and say, well, we do actually have some chance. So we have to focus on the pathway to getting to that outcome where they actually do make the playoffs, kind of push that other stuff out from their mind, have that cognitive dissonance, and just try to win with this, because this month is going to make or break their season.
And they're aware of it. Like Kevin Gausman said a couple weeks ago, I think he told Rob Longley of The Sun, like, hey, if we don't get it going, we know we're not going to be together very long. Like, they're aware of that.
100%.
Yeah. How could you not be?
Yeah.
It's, you listen to Jays Talk Plus every yeah. day in the clubhouse, and yeah.
There's just so much, like, yeah. They're not going to talk about it after the game and say, look, our playoff odds dropped again. But there's an awareness. These guys are surrounded by baseball 24/7. Of course, this stuff seeps into their consciousness.
Okay. The other thing too is like, and I've said this before, but like, even if you want to be cynical about what this point in the season looks like, baseball is a sport where if every individual does better, like everyone, the team will do better. So even if you're these guys and you like check out a little bit and you just want to like get your numbers up, like obviously there are some things you don't want to do. It can be too selfish. It can bleed into other guys. But if every guy was just like, you know what, I got to get my OPS up 50 points, next contract, whatever, the team would be doing way better. So even if you're not doing the kind of rah-rah, let's, you know, major league style, let's get up to third place in the division and stick it to them kind of stuff. Yeah, there's a reason for everyone to kind of look in the mirror and be like, I should be better. I need to be better. Okay, they didn't get it going offensively yesterday. Corbin Burns was very good. As John Schneider said after the game, Corbin Burns is a really good pitcher, but you can't say that about everybody you face, right? It's true. Apparently you can, because it has felt like they're doing that against like everyone other than Quinn Priester and Nick Nistrini.
Quinn Priester.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. They've gone 26 games with a run in the first inning. 5 off the major league record. It's I think it's the longest one in decades, except for the Giants had one that spanned multiple seasons, which I don't really count because that's two different teams, two right. different seasons. Most of this is just, if you're a bad offense, random stuff is going to happen, like yeah. the cleanup hitter drought, like the 20 games without scoring over 5 runs. Is there anything in the underlying first inning stuff that, you've been able to parse out or you know, ask anyone about that makes any sense?
Okay, so like it's obviously not good, right? This is clearly a bad trend to have happen to your team. At the same time, what if we said they've gone 30 games and they haven't scored a run in the seventh inning, you know, or the fourth inning? Like, okay, like it seems a little bit random. I think we attribute a bit more meaning to it because it's the first inning. And look, that is the one inning where you control who's batting.
Yeah, it's your best players.
It's your best hitters. Yes.
It would be so nice to lead a game.
It would be, 100%. So I think it's a little worse than, you know, we haven't scored a run in the seventh inning for a whole month. But I do think that if I'm looking at this offense and trying to assess it, I'm just looking at the runs per game, WRC+, you know, OPS. That's what I'm looking at. I'm not looking at the inning by inning breakdown.
Okay.
What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's good. I think there's an element of this, and like the best, I think what's most concerning to me is that the best explanation I can come up for it is does not translate well to playoff baseball if they were to get there. And the best explanation I can come up for it is this is a team that's very swing decision and grind, long at-bats oriented. Let's get into a bullpen. Let's see lots of pitches from a guy. Bo Bichette and George Springer rank second and third in Major League Baseball and how much of a benefit they get from seeing a pitcher a second time. So there is maybe a belief philosophically and strategically of like, okay, we can slowly get into our offense in a game. That'll benefit us as the game goes on. But the two problems I have with that are, one, we haven't actually seen that much of a benefit. Bo and Springer have second time seeing a pitcher or whatever, but overall, this offense is still really bad. It's not, they do well in the second inning, but it's not like they're beating the brakes off of bullpens and stuff like that. Second thing is, come playoff time, if they were to even get there, which feels like a big if now, yeah. You don't see a lot of pitchers a second time through, a third time through, and teams are going to shorten games on you and bring in just an army of those bullpen guys that it doesn't really matter if you, it still matter. It's better to have a good at-bat than a poor at-bat and get the pitch counts up, but it's not as if the, hey, 5 one-inning guys you're going to see in a playoff game are worried about, well, what if this guy sees me a second time? Like, it's not, that's the only explanation I can come up with for why the first inning might be worse than other innings. And I would get it, but only for a, like, we got to get to the playoffs, not as a playoff stretch.
Right. And man, getting there are so many steps that have to happen before you get there. And I think that if they do somehow get there, man, there are some other problems too with this team. Like, for example, the fact that they give up so many home runs, the fact that they don't hit many home runs, the fact that they have two relievers, if we're including Chad Green, that you really trust and maybe, you know, like there are a lot of question marks beyond that. But really, if you're trying to navigate a 7-game ALCS, I mean, you're going to need more than two relievers. Right now, I see two that they trust.
What I would give to talk about things I'm worried about in an ALCS series right now.
Well, this is the thing, is you're so far to get before that point. And so,
And I do wonder with some of the ways they're built and stuff like that, if they did not learn all the lessons of the last couple of years. And again, we'll talk about that in the second segment, the kind of big picture stuff here. Last one for you on kind of the more micro stuff. And last night, we saw Vlad play third again. It's fun. It's interesting to change it up, especially when the game's 10-1 and he gets a couple balls hit to him. It's a little different, but I think it's a little on the nose, and it's not very good that the reason Vlad is playing third base is to get more bats in the lineup, and those guys have an OPS of 610 and 637, respectively.
100%. So let me throw this at you. So, Vogelbach, his at-bats have been a lot better. His quality of contact has been a lot better. At the same time, this is a guy who was on pace for a 3-home-run season. So we're not talking about someone who is transforming the offense of the Blue Jays. Again, his at-bats legitimately have been better. With respect to Turner, you know, I think you could safely ease up on his playing time, right? You can dial that back. Here's my question for you. I'm sort of becoming, especially if Vladdy's playing third, I'm becoming more open to the idea of finding a way to get Spencer Horwitz onto this roster and have him be the one to play first base along with Vladdy at third.
Well, that's International League Player of the Week, Spencer Horwitz.
That's right.
You're talking about 5-hit game on the weekend, couple of home runs over the weekend. We also, here's an interesting one that I want to dive into with a scout person at some point. Baseball America just came up with, they just dropped park factors for the last couple of years. So we've never had minor league ballpark factors. We've known, the PCL is a hitter's environment. The Charlotte team, the White Sox AAA affiliate, that stadium's a bandbox. And during the 2021 season, people have talked a lot about, Vlad hit that high water mark because you know, the AAA parks or whatever. And that's like AAA ballparks are easier than Major League ballparks generally. But Salem Field in Buffalo graded out as like well below average, especially for left-handed hitters. So the fact that Spencer Horwitz and Addison Barger have put up the numbers they have, yes, the AAA offensive environment is much higher. So you can't look and be like, well, 900 OPS, yeah, that'll transport to the majors. Well, when you're comparing to the rest of AAA baseball, it is even more impressive that they've done it in a park that isn't that great for left-handed hitters.
It also makes it just all the more remarkable that David Schneider has been able to replicate what he did. But yeah, so what do you think about Horwitz then as a call-up?
Yeah, I mean, I like Horwitz a lot. He came on the show last week and we chopped it up. I did a thing on Blue Jay Central on him, not this past weekend, but the weekend before, about how good the swing decisions are. You know, he is among the leaders in all of minor league baseball in not swinging at bad pitches, at barreling up what you do swing at. He's got like the seventh highest line drive rate that
he
we
can
have.
Hit velo?
Yeah, he can hit, you know, there is a spot in his like swing profile that maybe guys will pound it up and in or whatever, but he has done, like, we're talking like, oh, his average drops to like 240 against that stuff, not his average drops to like 110.
Right.
And yeah, it's like, yeah, he only has four home runs, but doubles are pretty valuable too. Walks are pretty valuable. I would take some guys on base here. So I'm for it. I don't know corresponding roster move, what that looks like, because I just think even though they haven't used the bench that much and they haven't gotten much out of the bench, a team that has Turner, Vogelbach, Vlad, and Horwitz all on it, plus a backup catcher who, you know, in Kirk, who some backup catchers maybe have more like utility in terms of situational play. That's like almost a pure backup. It's a pretty inflexible roster at that point. But if it's a better one offensively, I'll take it at this point.
Right. And I agree with that. And that is definitely the primary counter argument against it. And it's a valid one for sure. I think it's the one that the Blue Jays would make. I've heard Blue Jays people make that case, along with the fact that, hey, maybe Spencer Horwitz wouldn't play enough to justify him being up.
He's closer to 27 than 26 at this point. It's his third year in AAA.
Get him up here, like, from that standpoint. And then from the standpoint of the roster, well, I would say one, okay, that's a bigger question about the roster, that you have this inflexibility, that you have these, you know, kind of DH types. But within that, you have to make the most of it. And so maybe there's a way, is it, you know, does Ernie Clement or Justin Turner have like a nagging, I don't know. Sometimes guys have stuff that we don't know about.
I would imagine the oldest player in Major League Baseball has some sort of nagging thing that...
So maybe you give one of those guys a break. I'm not saying you DFA someone, but you give one of those guys a break in the IL, you get Horwitz up, you just see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, look, even the Vogelbach thing, I know he's been better lately and had the best OPS on the team over a three-week stretch or whatever, but like, I don't know, man. You've got to do... It is pretty remarkable within how bad this season has been as well. And I know they're dealing with some starting pitching injuries now, and Bowden Francis and Yariel have been hurt. Romano's hurt. Manoah's hurt. But on the position player side, like, they have 28 plate appearances total from guys who weren't the opening day or the planned opening 13. Like, Brian Servin played a couple games. He started twice, I think, and was a backup a couple times. And then Addison Barger got those five games. Like, they've been remarkably healthy.
Oh, yeah.
And like, illnesses and stuff like that. But like, every team probably, if you were doing 30 radio shows, you probably would have talked about that for 30 teams by now. Yeah, so they don't even have that. They've been like remarkably healthy on top of everything else on the position player side.
Well, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, like, and, you know, knock on wood, we don't wish an injury on anyone here, but there's no one hurt on this team, on the position player core,
yeah,
right now. So they have an entirely healthy group of position players. That group, it's not a question of health. That group is just not getting it done offensively. They have been better in the last month or so, but even in that last month, they're slugging in the 300s. It's a singles and walks team, which can be okay. That's not the biggest problem with this team at this moment, but it is not a particular strength of the team either.
And there's a huge, like, we're not well-equipped to capture this, like, quantitatively necessarily, but there is a big quality of opponent factor in this offensive upturn too, right? Like, they've been better the last couple weeks, and they only saw Garrett Crochet once in the six games they played against the White Sox. They got Nick Nastrini in his ERA of 6 at AAA twice in that stretch. Chris Flexen shut them down. They saw the Pirates without Jared Jones, yep, and without Paul Skeens with a AAA call-up starting one of those games. Even the Tigers series where they didn't, yep, play well, they missed Tarek Skubal.
That's right.
So, like, there is
they got
a...
Maeda.
Yeah, and like, look, there, and I love Kenta Maeda. He's been one of my favorite
too.
Pitchers.
I was so wrong about him this year.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
No velo.
But like, you look at these things, and yeah, they still rank third overall this year in terms of like, on a pitch by pitch basis, quality of competition, Thomas Nestico, who's been on the show before, has come up with a quality of pitching competition metric, and the Jays rank third. But you play in the AL East, look at their June schedule. It's not going to get any easier. And yeah, I don't feel that good about the 3-week upturn in offense. I felt pretty good about Vlad's turnaround. It's nice. Like Varsho, we know will have these hot stretches of power and stuff like that. But I don't feel great big picture about that you turn things around offensively against weaker competition and still couldn't hit home runs, and B, that, yeah, you're now sacrificing defense to get offense in the lineup, but the offense you're getting in the lineup is like 600, 650 OPS, guys. It's a pretty bleak spot.
Yeah.
It begs the question, Ben, how did we get here? Let's take a break. When we come back, let's take a bigger picture look at, you look back to the 2016 wildcard game. The Toronto Blue Jays we had a sense that they were at the end of that stretch, at that window, rather. The front office had changed over. We heard things like, hey, there was criticism of Anthopoulos for pushing all in when they maybe shouldn't have. The Orioles, meanwhile, lost that wildcard game and gave it one more kick the next year. They didn't blow it up immediately. They tried to be competitive that next year. Around 2018, both of these teams started selling off and trying to retool. The Jays got back to being competitive a little quicker. The Orioles took a little longer, bottomed out a little lower. But this is what the Orioles are doing is what the Blue Jays envision. Hey, there's Vlad and Bo and there's Cavan and there's, quote, waves of pitching coming and things like that. These franchises could not be further apart. We'll take a break. We'll keep Ben Nicholson-Smith in here in the studio with us, and we'll try to figure out how these two teams diverged on similar paths on similar timelines. As Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Ailish Forafar.
And I'm Justin Cuthbert.
Join us as we discuss the most important sports stories of the day and tee up the biggest games of the night.
It's The Fan Pregame, 6 p.m. weekdays on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy alongside Ben Nicholson-Smith in studio here, who is wheeling and dealing during the commercial breaks. big fantasy trade news to make.
Hey, you know what? There's no bad time to make deals. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, it's a little tough on air, but when we get the call in stuff, we can't do live call ins, but we could do the voicemail thing. You can negotiate through that if you're here one time for one of the call in segments or something.
I appreciate that flexibility. Yeah.
How is the season going for you in that regard?
So far, so good.
Okay.
I don't want to get ahead of myself or jinx anything.
Okay. But. Because you could be the 2020 Blue Jays and you just added a couple nice guys to your core and you think, hey, this is a keeper league. I'm going to be competitive for years. I've got these couple young studs with a low auction inflation price coming. And yeah, I've got waves of pitching on the minor league slots. And then it doesn't work out, Ben.
Well, it sounds familiar. It sounds oddly familiar. And I mean, yeah, this is really a moment of a reckoning for the Blue Jays, a turning point for this team, I think, to try to figure out what this looks like. They hope to stay the course, and they hope that turns them into a contender this year. But I think objectively, we look at this, we can all see that it's more likely they're at least making a slight pivot toward 2025.
Yeah, and I think that's going to make sense. I know some people want the whole blow it up thing. That doesn't seem particularly realistic to me. It doesn't seem like something this front office would do. And, there are considerations like you just invested $400 million in a new stadium and stuff
like that.
It's just
not happening.
New stadium, renovated stadium. Let's take a look at how we got here. So I mentioned before the break, in 2016, the Jays beat the Orioles in the wild card game, one of my favorite games that I've ever been to. And from there, the Orioles in 2017 try to run it back. They're under 500. And then they decide, you know what? We got to redo this thing. And they have the appetite to really tear it down. They bought him out for four more seasons after that, and their winning percentage gets as low as 290. Like, they really bottomed out. But by 2021, they were already that's a plucky team. They're going to be difficult to beat. And by 2022, they were serious. And 2023, they made the playoffs. And now 2024, they're probably headed for their second 100-win season in a row. So they have done this quickly. And they are not... You can't look at the Baltimore Orioles example and be like, that's what a team should do. Because the Baltimore Orioles have nailed almost every high draft pick. They've been exceptional in executing this.
Yeah.
But the Baltimore Orioles, in roughly the same timeline that the Blue Jays tried to turn things around, maybe they gave themselves an extra year and they bottomed out a little further, but they have restocked the farm system, graduated talent to the major leagues, got back to the playoffs, won actual playoff games. Did they win a playoff game? Did they get swept last year?
They were swept.
They did not win a playoff game, but they did that in the second round.
In the second round?
Remind me. Did they win the division?
No. Rangers swept them in the first round.
Okay. So they have gotten as far as the Blue Jays in the playoffs. And they're headed there again pretty comfortably here. They are also one of the very best farm systems in all of baseball, despite graduating a bunch of guys to the majors. They also have a bottom eight payroll. Some of this again is like, yeah, you nailed a bunch of top picks. You did a really good job in the draft. You were super patient, maybe even patient to a fault at times. The Toronto Blue Jays had a similar timeline, didn't bottom out as far, did as much as they didn't really get as much back as the Orioles did for like Machado and VR and Bundy and Gausman and Britton. The Jays did trade away like Liriano and Pierce and Happ and Axford and Donaldson and Granderson and Russ Martin and, bunch of other stuff.
Stroman,
yeah. Stroman was like the one guy that actually returned something in Simeon Woods Richardson.
And Liriano. I mean,
Liriano for Teoscar.
As long as we're being, complete about this, that was an exceptionally good trade to acquire Teoscar.
Yeah, but it was.
There have been others.
Yes.
That were not as good.
Yes. And it's not even necessarily that they're bad. Like a lot of times in baseball, when you sell, you get a couple minor leaguers and who knows what they're going to become.
Yeah.
But the Orioles, so my point here is, similar timelines, Orioles a little more aggressive bottoming out and gave themselves maybe an extra year before trying to do that innocent climb back up. But they have executed so much more effectively and less expensively. So where do we start here with how one team in the same division, the same competitive environment, and with a smaller budget can do it so well and the Toronto Blue Jays have misfired?
Well, I think that the Orioles have had probably one of the most successful rebuilds in baseball history. The Astros rebuild was probably number one. And then some of those same executives, Sig Madahl and Mike Elias, go to Baltimore. And they have since done something just as impressive with the Orioles. We'll see where it leads. Obviously, you got to win for that really to reach its full, full kind of apex. But this looks like one of the best rebuilds of the 21st century, maybe of, maybe say all time. Then you compare the Blue Jays to that. I actually don't think that the Blue Jays rebuild, that pivot that they made from the, 2015, 16, 17 teams into this new era of Blue Jays, I actually think they did a lot of things right. They became a contender very quickly and they made it to the playoffs in successive seasons. So the first part of it was right. I just think what we're seeing now is this middle part where you're supposed to sustain. That's where it's going wrong. They're not sustaining this. They got there. They got to the point that they're a playoff team. But then you look at, we've talked about their offseason. This was an offseason where the moves just haven't worked. They have not allowed the Blue Jays to sustain this and maybe to pass these up-and-coming teams like the Orioles.
So when we look at this, there are a couple different ways to build a baseball team out, right? And there is draft and develop. There is international free agent signings and develop. There is the major, like the pro free agent bin. There are trades. Those are kind of the four key ways. I think the Jays have done a pretty good job turning international free agent guys into major league teams. Like they've been one of the better teams in baseball.
Yeah, I would say that's maybe, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they've been borderline elite there.
Yeah, they've been good.
Andrew Tanish has done a great job.
However, and so they've done a great job on the international signing guys, getting guys like, Vlad was the prior front office, but...
Well, Tanish was there for Vlad.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's a positive. They have... The trades haven't been like overwhelmingly amazing, but they haven't been overwhelmingly bad. The guys you gave up for 2 years of Matt Chapman, none of them have really done much.
That's a great trade.
Yes, you gave up Simeon Woods Richardson, but you turned Stroman into him and got Jose Berrios back. No one's arguing with that one. The Teoscar for Eric Swanson and Adam Mackle one. Mackle's having a good season.
That might be a really bad trade.
Yeah.
That might be a really bad
especially
trade.
Now knowing how last year played out.
I think the Teoscar for Swanson one looks like pretty rough.
Unless Adam Mackle like becomes a rotation guy, and he's having a nice season at Double A, but that's a long way off.
That's a long way off. So that one, let's say, looks pretty rough. The first Teoscar trade, elite. Yes. You turn Liriano into Teo. That's huge.
Yeah, and then there were a bunch of nothing trades, right? Like there were a bunch of trades that really didn't make a huge heck of a difference.
Most trades.
Yeah. And then the Gurriel and Moreno for Varsho 1 looked very bad last year. I think it'll probably look okay in time. I mean, I'm still a Gabriel Moreno believer. He's not having the best of seasons here. But Dalton Varsho's found himself here. It looks all right now that the Diamondbacks aren't, you know, in the World Series playing with both of those guys every day.
Yeah. I think that's a trade that the Diamondbacks make the World Series. You got to be thrilled with that trade if you're Arizona. For the Jays, it can still be a win because Varsho's a really good player.
Okay, so we have the international signing that's been pretty great. The trades, which have been fine to good, depending on where in this timeline we're looking at. And then the free agent signings, I mean, the George Springer contract we knew would not age particularly well. They've done a really good job identifying and getting starting pitching through free agency. And then on the position player side, they've done okay on a like pure dollar per win basis with like a Belt, a Kiermaier, Semien. Yeah. I mean, the Semien one kind of felt like a no-brainer. Like the fact that he was available on a one-year deal.
Got to get it done.
I know. It remains crazy.
Yeah.
But you get credit for that. They've done okay there.
Robbie Ray was a free agent signing.
Yeah.
I mean, so they've had
Robbie Ray they traded for.
And then signed.
And then re-signed. Yeah. Okay.
So they've had some, I mean, to sign the Cy Young winner on a one-year deal, to sign a 40 home run hitting second baseman on a one-year deal, they've had some incredible deals. That's the kind of offseason the Jays needed this year, right? Instead of going out and signing three DHs. So that's the kind of offseason that would have allowed them to keep this thing going.
So they have done an okay to good job in a couple of these territories.
Yeah.
That leaves us with the draft and develop. And look, the Major League Baseball draft, you're not going to draft someone in 2022 who's in the majors in 2024 unless you're like the Angels or Paul Skeens. You know, like it's just not very realistic. But this front office has been at the helm since 2016. I would say probably if we're crediting drafts and stuff like that, the 2016 draft to me is more of an Anthopoulos era draft because this front office took over kind of right before the draft. It was the same scouting people that he's now with the Angels, right?
Brian Parker led that draft. It was actually a great draft. So, you know, it's hard to really allocate credit and blame for these things, but certainly Brian Parker was not. He was only with this front office for one year before he was dismissed. He was more of an Anthopoulos, a guy. I think they worked together with the Expos as well. That draft, Bichette, Biggio, objectively a great draft.
Bichette in the second, Biggio in the fifth. So again, I personally would draw the line after that if we're evaluating this front office
in
the draft.
I think that's pretty fair because that's when you get to Steve Sanders, who was just here, and Shane Farrell.
Okay, so if we look at that timeline onward, the Orioles have right now 13 players on their active roster or IL that they drafted since then, and Jackson Holliday and Heston Kjerstad at AAA, who like they have more good guys in the farm system as well, but like two guys who probably could be playing in the major leagues right now. So that's 13 plus those two guys. That's total drafting, and 11 of those 15 are from the timeline we're talking about onward.
Okay,
the Blue Jays have 7, and Schneider, Pearson, Manoah are the only ones who were drafted and developed by this front office. That is, I know you've pulled numbers on draft stuff recently, and it takes a long time, and it's a bit of a crapshoot, and you trade guys away, et cetera. But the way this was supposed to build, the Cleveland mentality and things like that, and the way that you're supposed to do this sustainably, where you can also afford to keep winning, and not all, because even if you hit in free agency, that is a significantly more expensive way to make your team better than if you're your internal guys. So when we look at this, and the international signings have been pretty good, the trades have been okay to great at times. The free agent stuff has been pretty solid on a dollar per win basis. Does this come down to that there is a track record here if they haven't drafted a developed? Like, is that kind of the smoking gun here? Is they haven't been able to keep an internal supply of guys, whether for trade or for the major league roster?
Yeah. I think that that's pretty fair. And the numbers that I've looked at since 2017 would back that up. They would have the Blue Jays around 20th in Major League Baseball in WAR drafted since 2017. And look, this equation would shift if, okay, sure, they're 20th in WAR, but their farm system is elite. That's about to shift, but not the case, right? Their farm system, as ranked by third party, you know, places like Baseball America, would be in the bottom tier of Major League Baseball, in contrast to the Orioles, which would be in the top tier. So those are teams where you would expect that figure to keep growing and growing. For the Blue Jays, you look at the players they've drafted recently. Tiedemann, he would be someone that you would expect to really contribute. Davis Schneider, sneakily, from 2017, that looks to be an elite pick. This guy is a regular in the major leagues. I mean,
in a round that wouldn't exist anymore. He would have gone undrafted if he came up now.
50K bonus, like incredible story there. And yet, the Jays, especially on the pitching side, right? Like, to go out and acquire Ryan Burr, sure, that's you know, interesting. But I think it also speaks to where they're at from a pitching depth standpoint in this organization. And I remember when Mark Shapiro came in, he said, you know, that the Blue Jays in their AAA rotation did not have enough. I forget the exact line, but there was a line at the winter meetings, I want to say in 2016, where he was indicating that the Blue Jays at AAA just did not have viable options for this team. So here we are in 2024. Once again, they don't have a viable starter in AAA, right? This is why we're talking about the bullpen games. Nor do they really have viable relievers where you're thrilled to call those guys up. So I think especially on the pitching side, they have not drafted and developed enough to really keep that going sustainably.
It's difficult. And yeah, 2019, I see a quote here from Mark Shapiro talking about the waves of pitching prospects the club has developed. So this was maybe patting themselves on the back a little bit early. In 2019, in my mind, it was more of a 2016, 2017 quote of like, we are going to develop that. But they said it again in 2019. And that obviously hasn't been here. So where we're left is, you know, the Jays could turn this around. They could get back to the playoffs. They could retool for next year and get back to the playoffs. But when we look at this window and we're reaching a point where, who knows, maybe things turn a corner and get better and the window extends. But right now it looks like we're coming toward at least a pretty big decision point with this window, this core, and what was supposed to be a long-term thing that would be sustained by all these prospects coming up and an ability to spend on top of that has left the Jays where they're an average to slightly below average team. They can't keep up in their own division, which, yes, is difficult, but other teams are doing it less expensively. They are very expensive. Like, they're at their seventh or eighth in payroll. They pay the competitive balance tax, and they're old. On top of all this. So this is like, obviously the fixes we can talk about, you know, if they're going to, like, let's say they turn it around in June and they add a little bit at the deadline. Those are things that are going to help the major league club a little bit right now. But bigger picture, longer term, there has to be a change in how effective they are at, like, and I don't mean prospects just because like prospects are fun. They are. I love covering prospects and stuff. But if we're talking about the economic realities of baseball, like, the Dodgers have sustained this for a long time. The Braves have sustained this for a long time because in addition to having really good star players who you are okay paying star money, you have young, talented guys coming up, and those guys are inexpensive. Like, I hate the labor side of that and being like the surplus value, but like, that's how you sustain winning. And the Jays are in a spot where they're not very good and they don't have a great farm system and they're really expensive.
Right. And another part of Atlanta's success, again, like it or not, it kind of sucks for the players, but Ozzie Albies, Ronald Acuna Jr., Austin Riley, they have so many players that were signed to really team-friendly extensions. And I mean, I guess you could debate whether the Riley one is team-friendly, but they have a lot of team-friendly extensions on the books there that allows them to have cost certainty and to plan ahead. The Blue Jays, in contrast to that, have chosen a different approach where they do not have a lot of certainty with respect to what's going to happen with Vlad or with Bo. And so that means, you know, I'm not saying you even could have signed Vladdy to that Ozzie Albies extension. You probably couldn't have just because of, you know, his upbringing and the various factors there. It's going to be tougher to sign the son of a major leaguer to that type of extension. But the reality is the Blue Jays don't have those team-friendly type players on the books for them. So this is where you do need to have that pipeline of prospects.
And look, this is not a one or the other thing, right? Like, for the people who want them to blow it up and tear it down and things like that, I just pulled up the 2017 farm system rankings. And these are the teams that are the best teams in baseball now. The Braves had the number one system. The Yankees had the number two system. The Padres were fourth and the Brewers were fifth. Like, those teams all, and the Dodgers were sixth. Those teams have all been pretty competitive since then. Maybe the Brewers had a dip in there, but those other teams have remained competitive. The other thing too is, like, the Orioles were not even a top 10 system when they started this rebuild, and now their system is so good that they've graduated all these guys and they're the number one system still. So I just say this because I think sometimes people think of it as a binary win or develop thing. And in baseball, where draft picks don't make the majors for 3 or 4 or 5 years, and you have several levels of the minor league, like, there's Like, you can do both. It's not like the Jays have a bad farm system because they've decided to win now. That is a part of it when you look at trades and things like that. But you can do both. The good teams have done both. The Dodgers and Yankees and Braves, and to a lesser extent, the Brewers and Guardians have maintained good farm systems and being competitive. And in the case of the Brewers and Guardians, who are probably a tier down, have done so while staying really inexpensive.
Right. And again, the Guardians, which obviously is where Atkins and Shapiro came from. That's a long time ago. And you look at how things have been since there, the Guardians are actually elite when it comes to the amount of value that they have gotten from the draft. Like, they are getting so much war from the draft. Obviously, a lot of that is player development too, right? Like, they're picking guys who are maybe smaller in stature as hitters, not a ton of power. They develop them into bigger bats who are able to contribute at the major league level. And same with pitching. They've done a great job developing pitching. So that is, again, that's what the Blue Jays were supposed to be, is, hey, we might not be drafting 1-1, but we are going to develop. And the reality is Cleveland has done a great job of that, but that did not come with Atkins and Shapiro to Toronto as of yet.
Yeah, I know. And maybe they, you know, culturally and organizational structure-wise put the things in place there. But, like, again, we're talking about, like, a whole front office era ago when they were in Cleveland. Like if Anthopoulos in Toronto feels like a long time ago, well, that's when Shapiro and Atkins were in Cleveland. So I don't think they're, you know, they get credit for, I just brought up that the Guardians had a top 10 system at the time that they left. They get credit for that, but I don't think they're getting credit for, and like certain of their guys didn't click until afterward either, right? Like, you know, they're an interesting case study for a segment that has more than 3 minutes left. But several of the Guardians, like, biggest name prospects found their way to more power under the next regime. And I wonder if that's, you know, more of a, not analytics, but a way we develop and what we're focusing development on kind of thing as well.
Right. And it's not for a lack of infrastructure. I mean, the Blue Jays have, their infrastructure is great. That player development facility is great. So they have some of the ingredients there, but baseball is a results business, right? We care about what happens on the field. This is where, you know, and I say this all the time, but for all the amazing metrics in baseball, it's really win-loss, right? Yeah. Win-loss tells you so much about what's going to happen. Win-loss will tell us what the Blue Jays do. If they go on a run and get to 500, get above 500, all right, they're probably looking for relief help at the deadline. If they stay where they are, Jimmy Garcia is gone. Yusei Kikuchi's gone, and we'll see what happens from there. So, yeah, it's really simple, you know, as much as we dive into the details.
Okay, so having established all that about, you know, the draft and develop has been probably the biggest thing holding them back from taking the next step and things like that. And again, some of this is also, of course, on, like, if Bo Bichette were playing better, if George Springer were playing better, but we're talking the big picture organizationally here. Who should they take at number 20?
Oh, man,
I'm kidding. Okay, so they've got two more games left in the series. It's Jose Berríos against Albert Suarez tonight. Baltimore has a TBA tomorrow. We got a minute and a half left here. What are you looking for these next two games? Like, would a split make you feel all that much better? Or like, because, you know, you lost to their big arms, I don't know. Is it going to keep you warm on Thursday late evening?
Here's the thing. So if they win the next two, and even if they go on the road and they play tough on the road, they split, you know, on the West Coast and in Milwaukee, they come back after a 3-3 road trip, and then you come back, and who are they playing when they get back? It's the Guardians.
Yeah.
Let's say you win two or three from the Guardians, all right? So then, like, that's some good baseball that you've played, but you're still under 500. You're still not.
And the Guardians are 40-20. Like, it's not likely that you're taking two of three.
Right. It's not likely you're taking two of two against the Orioles right now. They're just in a tough spot. Yeah. They just are. And they can theoretically get out of it, and they should try to get out of it. I'm not saying, like, the players obviously should try to go on a 10-game win streak. I mean, you know, do it if you can. It's just a tough league, and they're in a tough position.
Yeah, and they've put themselves in this tough position. They haven't taken advantage of opportunities. They have not played well when the toughest competition is there. We'll see if they can do it against Albert Suarez, who was out of baseball for like 4 or 5 years in Korea, but now has a nasty cutter changeup combination at ERA under two. Be shocked if a guy like that nobody has remembered his name in 4 or 5 years shuts down the Jays. Ben Nicholson-Smith, thanks for taking the time out, buddy.
You got it.
Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet and Sportsnet.ca. I'll be watching the game with him down at the park a little bit later. We're going to take a break. In the second hour, we've got Hannah Kaiser coming on, as well as Trevor May. Had a great chat with Trevor May yesterday. We pre-taped it about his move from being a pretty effective bullpen pitcher last year to moving into baseball media. I did ask him if, you know, I tried to be like, hey, any interest in coming back and pitching with your 3 ERA last year? You can see how he answered all that as Jays Talk Plus continues on Sportsnet Radio Network.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Fun second hour here. We'll talk to Hannah Kaiser and Trevor May. While we wait for that, a little update on tonight. The Orioles had a TBA in the pitching slot. They're going to go ahead with Albert Suarez, as we kind of expected. Albert Suarez, an interesting guy, 34 at this point, and spent 4 or 5 years at a major league baseball. Last time we saw him was 2017 with the Giants, and then bounced around the minor leagues a little bit, went to Korea for a couple seasons, pitched, you know, pretty well there. And then the Orioles said, yeah, we could use some minor league depth, the swing man. He did pitch in the minors briefly, but he has a 1.57 ERA at the major league level in 34 and a third innings. He started 5 games for them, started a couple early in the year, went to the bullpen, has started a couple since. I don't think his 1.57 ERA is going to hold up, but he does have some good underlying numbers. The thing he probably does best is he does a good job limiting barrel rate. So, you know, how often you really get the barrel into the ball. And he does that two ways. One is that he throws a 95-mile-an-hour fastball that lives up in the zone. He has the third highest average height on his fastball among all pitchers in baseball. So, you know, we know that the Jays have struggled with that kind of guy. This year, the guys who really get down the mound and leave it up in the zone so that it comes at you on kind of a different plane there. And then he has a cutter and a changeup that play really well off of each other. And I'm going to break this down a little bit more on Blue Jay Central tonight. And normally when we talk about a righty and their changeup, that's a weapon to neutralize lefties. He uses it a ton against lefties. It's his number two pitch against lefties, but he'll throw it more than we usually see righty on righty. And I think why that is, in addition to the fastball that he's throwing up, he has a cutter and a changeup that he both throws low, and they have they're tunneled very similarly. And then the changeup has a ton of movement to one side, and then the cutter cuts the other way. So you get kind of these two pitches that stay low in the zone and move in different directions, and then the fastball high. So you're having to cover all four quadrants of the plate if you're a hitter. We'll talk more about Albert Suarez on Blue Jay Central later tonight. Right now, we'll see what Hannah Kaiser thinks of this Blue Jays team from afar. She's at MLB Now, SNY, The Ringer, everywhere else you get good baseball coverage. Hannah, good morning. Thanks for doing this. Hannah, I cannot hear you. You might be muted. Okay, I'm going to leave that to Hannah and Amit to figure out for a second here. But yes, we'll continue to tee up the Suarez matchup. Okay, we got the sound issue fixed. We're all right. Hannah, how are we doing?
Hi, sorry about that.
That's all right. How are you? How's the season been so far? We haven't talked in a little while.
I mean, honestly, okay, wait. This is not what we prepared to talk about. I think it's been a kind of mediocre season.
Okay. Okay. Why is that? Just nothing new, nothing all like last year we had all the rule changes. Yes. We had some young upstart teams come up, but this year it kind of feels like a run it back season from last year.
It does. It also just feels like I'm from Philly, so I should actually be thrilled about this season, but it feels like there are very few truly interesting, dynamic, dominant teams. The Phillies being one of them, but otherwise it feels like we're getting very excited as a baseball fan base about like the Reds, who are fun and young, but not amazing. Like there's no real, so far we haven't seen any, I don't think, true interesting, like dynamic team-wide breakouts.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it does, you know, the teams that are good are teams that we know a lot about already, right? Like we're not getting to know, this isn't the Orioles on the way up. They've already been up here. The Yankees.
Right.
I mean, the Yankees are the Yankees. Juan Soto's new, but the Yankees are always up there. We thought, Hannah, that the Jays might be up there as well. This was supposed to be, you know, year three or four of this core, this window climbing up. They haven't done that. Not only are they not even on the level of the Orioles or the Yankees, they're like five games back of the wild card with like infinity teams in between them. What is your read on the Jays from afar?
So you mentioned that I do MLB Now with Brian Kenny, who hosts that show regularly. And I think he recommends rebuilds too often.
Okay.
I'm sort of like, the rebuild is come and gone. It doesn't make sense in this day and age. You can't be rebuilding when everybody else knows about it. Draft picks don't mean as much, factor in the draft lottery, all that. The Blue Jays, though, feel like a team where it's easy to retroactively recommend a rebuild, I guess, but it does. I'm curious what you think about, like, should they have seen this string of slightly disappointing to greatly disappointing seasons coming? Because it does feel like yet another year in which, from afar, it looks like they have a lot of talent, but then it's not coming together. It's not actualizing. I was just looking at this is like such rudimentary analysis, but you know how FanGraphs does on their roster resource page. Mm-hmm. You can look at league-wide rankings. I mean, their offense, everything in the highest ranking in their offense is middle of the pack, 15th in on-base percentage, but otherwise it's all like 20th or something. The highest ranking at any point, bullpen, starting pitching, lineup, is 9th in walks per 9 in starting pitching. It just feels like I understand they're really good at defense. I think they're first actually in team defense in FanGraphs, but it's hard to see even how they intend to upgrade, because a lot of these pieces are pieces that were supposed to be talented that maybe even are performing well individually, but it's not translating to success. I don't know. You mentioned how far back they are of the wild card and how it's not super far back, but there are all these teams in between. They feel like one of those teams where it's like, this is maybe the problem with the expanded postseason, is everybody feels like they're in it, even when there's not a lot of evidence that the team itself is really working.
Yeah, look, if this were the old wild card era where there's only one team, the Jays are done. Like, they're 11 and a half, yeah. They would be 11 and a half back of the wild card in that scenario instead of five games back. Yeah, I think we'd be talking more about them being sellers. To your point about whether this was predictable, not to this extreme. I didn't think George Springer was going to get back to being George Springer, but I didn't think that it would be this big a struggle. I didn't, you know, maybe I didn't think Bo Bichette was, you know, going to be a 6-win player, but I certainly didn't think he'd have 2 months this bad. Now, we did enter the season where a lot of the conversation was, well, they didn't do enough in the offseason. The offense looks mm-hmm. too weak. You know, the bullpens, every bullpen in baseball is an arm too thin, but, you know, maybe they could have addressed it there. But they were also, like, because of all the free agent contracts, because they've built primarily through free agency other than Vlad and Bo, they were already, like, so heavily leveraged payroll-wise. Like, I think they're the seventh highest payroll team, despite being, you know, so far below 500. So it's I was not the most optimistic person in the world coming into the season, and this has underwhelmed even my pessimism. So it's been a tough one, Hannah.
Right. So I think they're the one team maybe that came in with high expectations that I think really should cut bait, consider some major trade pieces, just because I do think that they've gotten, let's speak directly, like they've gotten a lot out of Bo Bichette and Vlad Guerrero Jr. And those are exciting. Like the seasons they've had from them are fun and dynamic, but they haven't translated to October success. And so I think you just have to maybe like strategically think differently about how you want to construct this team. I was surprised to see Ross Atkins so vehemently tamp down any trade speculation this early, just because it could still get worse before the deadline.
It definitely could. And the Orioles being in town for a couple more and then a June schedule where you're playing like Guardians, Brewers, Yankees is not going to be friendly. Hannah, you've been doing a lot of stuff for SNY. So let's talk Yankees a little bit. Gerrit Cole on the way back. We've got his wife catching foul balls and his rehab start and stuff like that. Just how confident are you in it? I know you guys kicked around the conversation recently of like, did they peak too early? I'm personally not a big believer in that. Like, if you're good, you're good. Just how good can this Yankees team be?
Well, last night I was on, we were talking about does Gerrit Cole coming back make them the best team in baseball? And that's hard to say, you know, especially sort of what time frame are you talking about? But I was saying it certainly puts them in the best position almost of any team in baseball. I mean, every team deals with injuries, and it's not to say that injuries are an excuse, because certainly, you know, the Braves being without Spencer Strider, that's tough. They were expected to be a great team. He's an incredible pitcher. They don't have him for the whole year. They're struggling a little bit. So it's not that injuries are an excuse, but it's just that to play well when your best pitcher has not been on the team puts them in such a enviable spot. I mean, it's a comparison last night on SNY. Again, Phillies fan, watching a Phillies game recently. Ranger Suarez got hit by a comebacker. He's been incredible. They took him out of the game immediately, very precautionary, and he's fine, and he's going to come back, and he's not going to miss any starts, I don't think. But the Phillies could do that knowing that they've already kind of built up a lead in the division, that they are playing really well, that they are kind of already focused on October. The fact that the Yankees had to start the season without Gerrit Cole after having a terrible, disappointing year last year, they probably thought, like, this could go bad. We might need Cole. What if we get off to a tough start? And they didn't. They got off to an incredible start, and now they're able to be conservative, cautious, in how they work him back into the rotation. And that's a great spot to be. I mean, to be a team that is welcoming back the reigning Cy Young Award winner, but doesn't feel like they need to rush him back, and feels like they are already thinking about kind of how does this rotation fit together for later in the season, for into October. I don't think you could be in a better spot as a team. They might also be the best team in baseball, but certainly they're in the best spot in all of baseball.
So you mentioned the Blue Jays potentially, you know, being a team that needs to sell off, and they're going to be like 5-6 weeks from making that decision. But this is a Yankees team that, I mean, they're good enough that you don't look and see like, oh, they absolutely need this. If they did have a weakness that they might shore up by July, where do you think they would look?
I don't know, man. They've been really good, right? Like,
bullpen, right? Like, just in case.
It's always bullpen, but the bullpen has been good. I mean, Clay Holmes is really good. They have the second best bullpen ERA in all of baseball. I don't know. I think they're injuries. Maybe someone could get hurt, you know? Someone could always get hurt. DJ LeMahieu hasn't been playing well. I don't know. They could use some... a backup infielder maybe, but I think they're in a good spot.
They are in a pretty good spot, and they'll be in a good spot long-term if they keep Juan Soto. This is another thing. Apologies for redoing a conversation. I know you guys did the SNY Juan Soto next contract kind of conversation. Doesn't sound like, you know, an extension is very likely, but just how big are we talking? Like, obviously Shohei is Shohei, and I don't think anyone's ever going to touch that, but are we headed for like biggest other than Shohei asterisk?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I understand this is not like an anti-labor, he should have accepted it, that's a lot of money, what do you play a game for a living take? But the contract he turned down with the Nationals was huge. It was like $440 million. None of it deferred. The Nationals famous for their deferred contracts. None of that money was deferred. So he has established, and I understand that bought out some of the arbitration years that he's since made a lot of money in, but like that would have been a historic contract, and he has performed incredibly well since then. I think there's an impression that he was disappointing in San Diego because the Padres were disappointing. He was not. I mean, he struggled initially, but ultimately had a great couple of years and a half in San Diego. And this year is just, I mean, looking unstoppable. I think it'll be a huge contract. And I think the Yankees telegraphing their willingness to sign him to an extension when everyone's reaction to that has been like, Scott Boras would never do that, Juan Soto unlikely to do that. It is evidence to me that the Yankees have made a calculation that he is such a desirable player who fits in so well there that it is worth it to be on the record with their interest, even if it ends up ultimately driving up his price in free agency. And I think that is like an incredible compliment to him as a player, that the Yankees are willing to say, like, we would make this guy an offer in season, even though we tend to not want to do that kind of thing. Like that's only going to drive up his price. Whatever they offer him, he can take that to the market. Boras can take that to the market. So they've obviously decided that it is more important to get out ahead of being extremely active and interested participants in the Juan Soto sweepstakes. And that to me just speaks to how dynamic and exciting Juan Soto is.
Yeah, if I had a player who was on pace for like an 11 or 12 win season, I'd probably signal whatever I need to keep him as well. So, Hannah, Juan Soto will be headed to the All-Star game, of course. We found out yesterday that this year's Futures game is going to also have a skills contest. Guys are going to be able to hit at targets, call their shot, things like that. You tweeted you would like to see this at the major league level as well, but we got to add more to this, not just directional hitting. What are we thinking here?
Defense.
Okay.
We got to have some way to have defense in the All-Star game, I think, because I think it's the kind of thing that really doesn't come up, doesn't showcase well necessarily in the game itself. So the reason I really like that they're doing this skills contest is the Home Run Derby has become kind of the premier event, I feel like, of the All-Star game. It's feels like guys are trying harder in the Home Run Derby maybe than they are in the game itself. And I would love to find a way to encourage that level of effort to make defensive plays, because I just think you're not going to get that in the game. Guys are not going to go dive for a ball necessarily. I understand it. They don't want to risk injury, but I think defensive plays are really fun. I want we need to have like a home run robbery derby. I think that would be so cool. Plus then you could get Kevin Kiermaier to the All-Star game.
Yeah, or Dalton Varsho. You know, the Jays have some options, yes. And I don't know that anyone else is going to be, like, yelling for an All-Star spot the way things have gone, right. So that'd be fun. Yeah, you could do stuff, too. Like, I don't know, I want to see O'Neal Cruz featured in that arm, right? So maybe it's, like, the radar reading from third base, although injury-wise, they probably wouldn't want guys gearing it up all the way, but, you know, or you have to go into the hole at a shortstop and make a cool throw. How much ground can you cover? Things like that. So that would be cool. Do you have any ideas for how to get some speed in there? Like, I think, like, Ellie De La Cruz is on pace for 100 stolen bases. There's obviously O'Neal Cruz. There are a lot of fast guys around. Do you have an idea for how we work that in?
Okay. Back when I had a little video series, The Bandwagon, we talked about this once, and I should have looked it up because we had a whole specific idea, and it was like, you get one outfielder, one second baseman, and then you're like trying to throw a guy out who's stealing. Like, I like the idea of trying to combine some kind of defense and speed, because I think, right, because that's what you want. You want the close plays. I mean, that's what MLB has, that's what their new rules, what they constantly are touting with the new rules is that their research has shown people like speed, they like athleticism. Put those two things together, what really people like is close plays at the plate, at second base, at third base. So I would love to find a way to get more of that into the All-Star game.
And then, yeah, you talk about close plays at the plate. We could just have a sideshow of Tommy Pham fighting people after close plays at the plate. Okay, so this is, you know, I mentioned a couple shortstops here, and I had intended to make this a longer part of the conversation, but you wrote a thing in spring training for The Ringer about how the DH is universal now, but teams haven't used the DH particularly well. Those numbers have crawled up a little bit this season. The DHs league-wide are hitting a whopping 718 OPS, which is it's a little above average, but, you know, you're thinking, Toronto is a great example. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is playing third base sometimes so that they can get Daniel Vogelbach and Justin Turner both into the lineup, and both of those guys are OPSing like 600 to 650. League-wide, the highest offensive position is actually shortstop now. Why do you think this is? Like, why do you think teams have... We've known that the universal DH is here for a couple years, and teams have seemed to have gone in the other direction with properly utilizing it.
There aren't a lot of great DHs. So I actually think that the DH issue, which is lots of teams have terrible production out of their DH spot, is in some ways, when I started to look into it, this very interesting tip of the iceberg that when you dig into it kind of relates to virtually almost every trend we see in baseball, down to pitching velocity. I thought this was so interesting. Dave Dombrowski brought this up to me, that the reason this is such like a multi-level down kind of cause and effect thing, but the reason, one of the reasons teams don't carry dedicated DHs is because they carry so many pitchers because they're not pitching as many innings. So you need more pitchers to cover all the innings. You have, even with the extra roster spot, pitchers are taking up half the roster, so you don't have as many position player spots to play with, so you're not as willing to have someone on there who can only play one spot and it isn't a defensive position. So I just thought, like, the number of factors that are relating to why we're seeing this offensive fallow period for DHs is actually really interesting. And I wanted to make a distinction between being like, I'm not saying there's an easy, obvious fix. It's not like, look, everybody should sign JD Martinez for whatever he asks for, and, you know, success will follow. Didn't work for the Mets this year so far. It's more of a like a more complicated issue, because we're not developing really good DHs, because it's not a valued position, because guys know they're not going to get paid for it, because the things like the WAR penalty, the defensive WAR penalty that you get, doesn't incentivize guys to want to be specialized in that way, because they know it's going to hurt them in arbitration or in free agency. And so it's not like, I think, why are these teams being so stupid? They should all just sign whoever the latest David Ortiz is. The issue is that we're not developing David Ortiz's, and because we don't have them, they have to do something with that spot. Maybe the smartest thing to do with that spot, given the profile of the current, you know, player base, is to try to use it as this half off day. But studies have shown, or research has shown, that using it as a half off day is not a great way for guys to get good at DHing, because it's always moving around. It is a skill set. Thus, the problem kind of perpetuates. I do wish that we could find a way for, like, I think that it's maybe not the most pressing problem in baseball, but maybe if we do solve some of these other issues, like pitchers throwing more innings at less high intensity, that, like, eventually we can get to a place where there's room on the roster for teams to have, like, an Andrew McCutchen, for instance, who was a big feature of that piece, because he's a guy who has become pretty exclusively a DH later in his career and has gotten good at it. And that's a guy where, like, that's an interesting example, because it's like, that's a guy where he recognized that the DH was the smart career move for him, which is, of course, the opposite calculation that a lot of guys are making early in their career. So he did take the time to get really good at it, to practice it, to talk to guys who had done it, like David Ortiz, to figure out how to do it at a really high level. And then now they have this guy who's really good at it, and it makes sense to roster him, because they're getting that kind of production. Also, he's got this good veteran presence on an otherwise young team. So we need to kind of create the right circumstances and environment for guys to want to be good at it, and for teams to want to roster that kind of guy.
And yeah, maybe McCutchen is the model, where it's a guy who has aged out of being a premium defender, but still has the bat and the leadership and stuff like that. Maybe the Daniel Vogelbachs of the world aren't coming back necessarily, but more McCutchen types can. Hannah Kaiser, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Hannah Kaiser of SNY, of MLB Now. Make sure you keep an eye on her Twitter and all the great work she does at a number of different places around baseball. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Trevor May. He was as recently as last year in a major league bullpen. He's decided to make the move into baseball media. One of my favorite guys to listen to on a number of different podcasts and TV shows. We will talk to him next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. That's Welcome Home by Coheed and Cambria, which was the walkout music of our next guest. Had a chance to pre-tape an interview with Trevor May, former major league pitcher, contributor on Rates and Barrels, Foul Territory, May Contain Pod, and his own baseball YouTube channel at Trevor May Baseball. This is that interview from yesterday. Joined now by former major league pitcher, now analyst at Rates and Barrel, Foul Territory, host of May Day at Trevor May Baseball on YouTube, into the gaming sphere, the Twitch sphere, the 7-on-7 football sphere. Nothing Trevor May doesn't do, and he still made time for us. Trevor, thanks for doing this, man. How we doing?
I'm doing great. You did miss one thing that I'm a little bit upset about. I just got into knitting, so.
Wow.
I don't know why you should know that, but now you do. And so, yeah, I'm really bad, but I'm having way more fun than I ever thought I would have. So I also knit. Yes.
Look, there are a lot of things you could do with your hands while you have baseball on in the background. You could be on your phone. You could be on your laptop. I click through Out of the Park Baseball a bunch. But yeah, knitting seems like something that would not only be fulfilling, but also very much limit the second screen time. So good for you, man.
Yeah, you hit it right on the nail head. That is what we are trying to accomplish. So it's cool to, like, look down when you haven't really paid attention. You got, like, there's something you're making. So anyway, didn't want to talk all about knitting. I'm sure we have other things.
Yeah, it's fine. We can do whatever, man. It's my show. I can do whatever I want. I have in my notes, I want to talk to you about the Goofy movie, all sorts of stuff. We can go wherever. Let's do a little baseball first. So for anyone who doesn't remember, I mean, you're only 34. You walked away from Major League Baseball. You were pitching as recently as last year. Can you walk us through a little bit that kind of decision to stop on the pitcher side and kind of put your foot in on the media side here?
It comes down to this. I really wanted to do this. A lot of people, first thing they mention is like, you know, the difference in pay, and how hard you work to get there. You don't want to like give something up that you've worked very hard for, but, that all of those mindsets to me feel like, you have to, and, I'm not big on, thinking that you have to, do anything that's kind of, that takes away fun from me. And, I was happy with what I had accomplished. I was happy with, the progress that I'd made and all the skills that I've learned. And I found myself, my mind drifting to making, I wanted to make things. I wanted to talk about the game. I wanted to go, you know, I'm really into film and cinematography and all this kind of stuff. And all of the making media facets of it are just fascinating to me and things that I wanted to learn. And it turned out that I just didn't have the time to do it. And with my wife also, you know, full disclosure, she was a little over it too. So it was pretty, it was easier of a decision. I mean, it was very hard. It still is. I get the pangs, right? And I could still do that. I can go get that guy out. But then I think about everything that you have to do to go along with it, flying and being away and all this stuff. And it's just, I think I made the right decision. So that, a lot of that had to do with it. And it's not like I had nothing. It's not like I just made that decision to get away and then I didn't have anything to do after. I had something to do right away. So I am more busy now than I was then. And I am very happy about it.
You don't have to answer this if I'm putting you on the spot, but like you pitched pretty well last year. There are tons of pitching injuries every year. Like how many teams have called you and be like, are you sure about this? Like, you sure you don't want to throw a couple bullpens and see how it goes?
No, I wasn't that type of player, frankly. No. And I knew that. I knew it's not even worth really the phone call or the effort put into convincing someone to do something. That's just not, I don't make that big of an impact. So, but I think that a lot of, that the success is actually linked to the freedom you get from knowing it's the last time. And there's a certain level of energy. There's you can go a little deeper than you've ever gone before in terms of finding, you know, the will to move forward and to keep working. There was a quote, and I can't find it for the life of me, from David Ortiz, but he mentioned the same thing. I was like, you know, you're having one of the best years of your very good career, your Hall of Fame career. Why would you be done? He's like, I think that a lot of my success is because I know I'm retiring. And, there's something to that. But going out on your own terms is something that baseball players just don't do. They're told they're done. And they're told by lack of action by anyone going after them. I knew that was going to happen. Even after last year, I was like, I anticipated free agency being a kind of a little bit of a mess, which it was. And even though I had thrown, you know, one of my most effective years and one of my most consistent years, I still would have probably taken a pay cut from the year before. And that's just only going to happen because I'm going to be older. My velo wasn't going to be going up at all. It was only going to go down. So you slowly... slowly watch yourself decline, or, you know, if you got something that you're really excited about to do, it's just at the end of the day, you're like, I'm letting go of, you know, the competition side and the compensation side. And if you're okay with that and you're okay with those consequences, then that's all there is. And I tried to think of it that way. It's much more simple. It sounds easier than it was, though. I'll be honest.
No, it sounds like it. You put a lot of thought into it and a lot of care into it. And look, the early returns are, from a fan perspective and a listener perspective, great. Like the stuff on rates and barrels is awesome. The stuff on foul territory is awesome. Other than like, I assume Eno like sent you a care package of craft beer to like start that relationship off. That aside, what are you enjoying most about this so far?
The freedom, like the creative freedom, like something that just pops into my head, I can just do it. I think I built a skill set too, where I don't have to rely on anybody to get something from idea to out there, and that is something I worked very hard to do, and I'm very happy with that. So it's just like, for example, today big news broke. I don't know if We're talking about that, but about the betting.
Yep. Big betting scandal. Talk about it. We talked about it a little on the show on Monday.
And it's funny. I looked up my calendar, got my reminder, and I was in the middle of recording my own thing on it. So that's something I wouldn't have been able to do by playing. And I have, I just love that I can just wake up, something happens, and I can do a little breakdown on it because it's really interesting. It's something I thought about before. So I like that. I like that I can do that. And I like that I can be like, I don't feel very good today and I don't have to do anything. And it's, I'm yet to take that route yet, but I will. I'll give myself a day off one day. It's freedom. It's my decision. And baseball, you get to make very few decisions on your own, from where to be on what day to when you're going in the game. So there's a certain level of I don't know, agency that I feel like I haven't had in my adult life.
Well, that's great, man. I'm glad it's working out and you're enjoying it so far. You know, from the audience perspective, I think the fact that you are such a recent player gives such a helpful perspective, right? Like we're at a time where there's a lot of, you know, especially on a show like Rates and Barrels. I know on Foul Territory, you guys get into this stuff too, but it's more of a, hey, this is the ex-player perspective. Rates and Barrel with Eno, it's more of a, hey, we're going to take a more analytic bent, you know, look at pitch modeling metrics and what does this stuff mean? And your position as a player who would have been aware of this stuff on the inside as recently as last year, I think, like as an audience member, has been super helpful. How did you, like as a player, utilize that kind of thing or not utilize that kind of thing? You know, the amount of information that teams can make available to players if it's something they find helpful at this point.
Yeah, one of the fun things is, and it's represented in the stuff I make now, is like this is, I was trying to find these things while I was playing from a benefit for not only me, but also for like my teammates and stuff. So some guys would do like interesting things or be unique in certain ways, and I wanted to know why. So this comes from like just a curiosity standpoint. It kind of lines like the coaches' staff. This is what coaches do. Like the best coaches think this way. So a lot of people ask me, "Is this because you want to be a coach?" I think I just have this natural thing that would make me someone who would naturally want to coach. I don't want to coach yet, but I do. But like it would be nice to do it again from my own home and just kind of break down. Which I am actually. I have just been talking to a few players behind the scenes and just, you know, being available to some guys that I know and just like, hey, dude, if you ever want to talk or some whack out of whack and you just want to go over it or want me to look into it, I'll do it because I like it. It's fun. So that's the way I did it. I was always looking for ways to like get a little bit more information or what's something I can act on. What's something about a hitter that I can notice that I can remember? What's that one key thing that maybe lets me get him out, especially when it's their 2-3-4 guys, which I was facing all of the time. and you're a reliever. You have very little room for error. So it can only help you to find those things. So that was just part of the fun for me. I'm a nerd. I make spreadsheets, you know, like I like that. I've always loved math and how, you know, things are related to each other. And it's just that's how I went about learning to pitch and putting things into play on the field. So that was what, especially last year, I was just in there all the time. And a lot of the analytics I look for were always about where could this point me? So if I think something's happening, finding the numbers that tell that story, and then I can see how, if they changed or not. So that was kind of the rinse repeat kind of. I think I'm tipping, but am I tipping, or is there something changed in speed? And I'll go or in movement, so I'll go check the movement of the pitch. That's fine. Location of the pitch. That's fine. Okay, maybe they know. So then let's go look at tips. So it was like I came up with these processes for how I would check in, and it became kind of my checks and balances system, which I think everyone needs. Everyone has a system like that. It just looks different. A lot of guys are just going by their eyes. A lot of guys have their own reports and they have numbers to attach to what their eyes see. And that's kind of how the game has evolved.
I think this is really helpful to hear for baseball fans. I hope anyway, because, you know, especially in Toronto where things haven't gone well and there was the big, you know, Jose Berríos taken out of the playoff game decision last year, you know, the analytics team has kind of become like a boogeyman word, right? Of like, well, anything I don't like, the analytics made them do it. But the way, and I know you haven't been in the Blue Jays organization and it's probably operates different from the Twins organization or the Mets organization or the A's organization. But the way you're describing it is that, you know, this can be a bottom up approach in addition to a top down. It's not just them pushing down, hey, this is how we want to play. Here's the strategy. Here's the numbers. There's room for the players who find it useful and are curious about it to, I mean, it sounds like you were doing a lot of independent stuff as well, but I'd imagine the better resourced organizations, you know, there's a pretty good information flow there as well. If you, you know, wanted to grab a coach, and I don't mean this as like a negative about Oakland or any specific team, but how, like, is that how it flows? And is that how you envision like an organization who utilizes these kind of analytics well, having that information flow?
Yes. The best teams are able to go top down and then are open to bottom up. So that's a little bit of the difference, I think, between the ones that are operating really well and then the ones that are not quite there yet. It's teams have to have philosophies. You have to have a philosophy as a team, because that creates a winning seasons, but it also creates year after year like quality approaches, so that when you have turnover of players, which happens fast, and like, dynasties aren't built in baseball. Back-to-back World Series are rare, even more rare, I think, than other sports. And it's not something you can count on, but you can count on being there, like the Astros and the Dodgers. And like these teams do the same thing every year, but they have different players. They have their core, but they have the new guys that join that group suddenly are bought in and then become another good player. Like, you know, when Kyle Tucker joined the Astros, and what, like, these guys buy into their team's philosophy. So the team having a philosophy is very important. Some teams don't have one. They don't. Not really. It's kind of, but they're not quite set, and they're searching a little bit. And some teams are very locked in what they're due. But I think the best ones have the types of guys, the people in charge, the pitching coaches and the pitching personnel, where they can give you something. You can give them something back and say, hey, actually, if I think about it this way, it works a little bit better. And they're open to that. Or you can bring something to them. I talk about Jeremy Hefner all the time. He's a really good friend of mine from the Mets. He is that type of guy who'd be like, hey, Trev, have you thought about this? I'd be like, no, I haven't. He'll even give you like an article someone wrote, because he's always looking for that kind of stuff to kind of buy you in. He understands what pitchers respond to. Some guys just want to be like, tell me where to throw it. Some guys want to be like, give me the information so I can decide where to throw it. And he's willing to do both. And then he's willing, if you go, hey, have you heard about this or tried this or this tunneling thing or whatever? And he'd be like, no, I haven't seen that. Tell me about it. And then he's open to that too. So I loved that. That's why I think I was so successful whenever he was involved in the organization I was with. And it made me be in the computer room all the time with the analytics people, because they were on the same page. I could be like, hey, what do you think of, have you seen anything where if something moves like this, people are swinging like this, does that sound weird? Like, let's look into it. And they were open to that. And that's what I always responded to. And some places, you know, their analytics departments are maybe a little newer, or they have younger, less experienced people. And they're like, I don't know if I'm supposed to talk to this. I don't know if the organization wants you to do that. And that somehow sometimes gets in the way. But they're on their way too. I think everyone's kind of moving in this direction. Just some teams are further along than others.
Yeah, with the odd one or two, you know, analytics don't exist at altitude is a phrase that I've heard, you know, about one team that maybe isn't as up on those things.
Oh, they do. They should probably look at them, because the analytics just changed. The physics work differently there than everywhere else. That's probably pretty important to know.
No, I'm saying that they don't invest that much. Like, the analytics don't exist up there because of, you know, organizational philosophy.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense, Rockies. You should probably have
more than anyone.
They should be working hardest on this, figuring this out and doing it, because there's a lot of advantages. Other teams go in there, it's very hard. If they knew and other teams didn't, they probably have a big advantage. So
yeah, there was even one last year where I don't know how recently you pitched at Coors or what your memories are like pitching there, but you know, there was one with the Jays where Trevor Richards, the movement profile on his changeup changed completely in the two appearances that he made in Colorado, and we asked him about it a little bit, and he didn't. Yeah, Trevor Richards is not a guy that talks about this stuff a lot, so there wasn't much of an explanation. But the best I could come up with is, yeah, certain pitch types are going to break completely differently at Coors. And I'd imagine that changes park to park, but Coors is going to be the most extreme.
Yeah. Anything that involves air and like air buffeting the ball, it disappears in Coors. I did pitch there last year. Fortunately, it went well, and I got, frankly, a little bit of help. But yeah, changeups don't, nothing vertical goes vertical, or nothing vertical goes as vertical as it's supposed to be. No, there's no air to catch the top of the ball, and no sweepers work. They all have more vert. Basically, they just fall. Gravity takes them. ride fastballs disappear. My ride was like 16 and a half on average last year, and then it was like 10 and 11 there, which is almost a sinker, which is bad. So you have to rely on velocity, and you can't rely on throwing up in the zone. But like gyro sliders, they're the same because they don't rely very heavily. They're smaller breaks. They're harder. They don't rely heavily on air buffers catching the ball in any way. So they break kind of normally. So you got to know that stuff. Curveballs don't work. Sweepers don't work. Forcing fastballs don't work. But it's funny. Sinkers don't really sink either because there's no air below, or there's no air on the side or on top. So they don't like go hard. It's just, they're just kind of bad sinkers. So fastballs are bad just generally. There's a little breakdown for you.
Yeah, Jays don't play at Colorado again this year, but pocketing that one for next year for sure. Wanted to ask you about a pitch design thing, and I don't know how much you played around with this stuff from a pitch design perspective in the offseason, you know, with those Rapsodo cameras or whatever, where you can kind of learn about what you're doing pitch-wise. But I do know that you tried a splitter for a little bit and then went away from it. What is it about a splitter that, because the Jays are kind of, you know, a splitter forward organization. Kevin Gausman, obviously, Eric Swanson has one. Bowden Francis has added one this year. And I know splitter usage is up around baseball, but we're up to like, 3% of all pitches are splitters because they seem to be very hard to throw. What was it about the splitter that why you wanted to try it and then why you went away from it?
I threw a straight changeup for a long time. It was always been my most, comfortable and consistent pitch. My changeup was road. Actually, my highest ride pitch in my career is a changeup. So I could throw them high in the zone all the time, but like that's not where you're trying to throw it. And so I needed something that moved a little bit more. I messed with two seam grips, could not get it to work. So I went to a splitter during the lockout year. Now I don't think I handled this well. The problem with learning a splitter is that the amount of time, it's not a grip and rip. Like I learned this pitch in the all over the All-Star break, I'm going to throw it in a game, because the tendency is to get a splitter to move. You usually guys tend to change their arm path if they're not really, really smart about it, which is what happened to me. So I actually hurt myself. That's why I got rid of it. It moved great. It became a pitch that was the only thing that was effective to me before I got hurt, but I was throwing it so much that I was hurting myself, and my ride on my fastball disappeared. It hurt every other pitch too. So it hurt to throw every other pitch, and everything stopped moving well, and I all in my splitter, which then hurt. So it was just like a catch 22. So when I took time off, I tried to come back throwing the splitter, and my ride disappeared again. When I was throwing in bullpens, I was like, there's something wrong here. So I went back to straight change, like, let's figure it out. And then in the middle of a game in August, when I was back off the IL in 2022, I turned the ball to be, it was just kind of a throwaway like idea I had, and it was fading like crazy. I had 5 more inches of depth, but it was like arm side run was like plus 8 inches. And I read an article about how important it is to get 15 inches of run because it looks like your fastball. I found a way to do it. And then it turns out that I basically started throwing a seam shifted changeup before I knew what seam shift, the term seam shifting was. I got a video on YouTube if anyone's interested in that. It's only a minute long, so it explains what seam shifting is. I won't do that here. But it basically allows you to throw something that looks like your normal fastball. I'm a supinator. Everything looks like a cutter kind of out of my hand. And a lot of guys are like that, but it allows me to get a lot of movement the opposite way. So a hitter sees something weird and then it moves completely opposite the way they're used to moving. And that is what you're seeing now. A lot of guys throwing seam shifted changeups as well and calling them splitters. But the reason splitters have become in vogue or become part of the meta is because hitters have adjusted to sliders, and that is what happens. Also, guys who throw 100, it's the reason people didn't throw them is because they couldn't figure out how to throw them. And now we know what seam shifting is. So people who are supinators who were trying to like turn, like to pronate the ball and like spin it, like kind of like a Devin Williams. Everyone's trying to throw the Devin Williams changeup. That's what it's always been, but no one can do it. He's like the only one who can do it. And so they had to find a way to get that same action, but with the spin axis that they already have. And that is what happened. People learned how to do that. And that's why everyone has a changeup now. And changeups are very effective when you throw 99 miles an hour.
Yeah, I would imagine most things are more effective if you can throw them 98, 99 yeah. miles an hour as well. Wanted to ask you some, you know, this has been great talking about your career. Major League Baseball wise, I know you're kind of keeping an eye on everything with foul territory, with rates and barrel. Do you have an impression of the Jays this year from afar? They've kind of been, you know, every time I have a national person on the show, they seem as perplexed as we are inside of it every day that this Jays team continues to underperform expectations and, you know, where we thought they were headed a couple years ago.
Yeah. You know, it's a classic, like a very highly touted core comes up and there's expectation attached to that. I was part of one as well with the Byron Buxton, Miguel Sano, Max Kepler, Jorge Polanco group in Minnesota. And you know, the Bichettes, the Biggios, and the Vladdy, you know, this group of guys, I wouldn't say they've underperformed per se, because the team definitely got much better with them and has had more success and has playoff appearances. It just hasn't shown up after past that. I don't know. There's been a lot of conversation about, like, Vladdy and his ability to impact games long-term this season. He had one really great year, and after that, he's been a good major league player, but it's not a, he's not a perennial all-star the way that people anticipated him being. And Bichette's kind of been on a roller coaster. He had a tough year, then he had a really good year, and he's having a tough year again. And he's had a lot of drastic changes in his swing. He's got one of those kind of, like, I don't know. He looks like he grew up in the Josh Donaldson baseball at school of baseball, where they have very similar swings. There's a lot of moving parts. So those two guys need to be the core of your team for them to be the best version of themselves. And this year they haven't been. And when they're not, the team underperforms, in my opinion. But the pitching's there. I mean, you got Bassett, Kikuchi, Gausman, Barrios throwing really, really good this year. Like, arguably, probably the strongest start he's had in his career, being a very talented guy. But it's just, when are these things happening? And they're always in that division too. So I try to use that as a grain of salt. That's the division's so hard. It's there's no good pitching parks. You know, pitchers, I feel like pitchers don't have the same advantage in that division that they do everywhere else. It's a little bit more even, and things can snowball a little bit. And then they're all big markets, and there's a lot of pressure. So, like, there's just a combination of all that. Being the only Canadian team, there's a lot of responsibility, right? So a lot of expectation, and they're still they're still hanging around, right? It's funny. They're only like five games away from a wild card. The way the playoffs are set up, it's possible. But I would say I feel the same way. Like, I mean, Danny Jensen's batting second right now. You know, Danny will tell you he's hitting really well, but Danny will be like, you know, a team that I'm hitting second on consistently is probably not winning all their games. It's just that he's not a hitting first catcher. So they need their guys to step up, you know, and Springer's getting older. It just seems a little lackadaisical. It seems a little bit going through the motions at times, and they need their two superstars to be superstars. And they've been very good players. They just haven't been consistent superstars, which is, I think, necessary for this team to kind of win a World Series.
All right, let's end it on a lighter note. You recently ranked your 12 best Little League snacks from the 90s in a YouTube video. Again, that's about Trevor May Baseball on YouTube. I know you weirdly didn't pitch very much when you came to Toronto, but you spent most of your career in the American League. I imagine you were here a bunch. Were there any, like, bullpen snacks or snacks in general that you would look forward to getting in Canada, because you can only get them in Canada? They're easier to find in Canada.
So you would think that the answer to that is yes, but no. It's pretty straight. Oh, so Canada, one thing that they do have in the clubhouse in Canada that has in Toronto that has lived on after the wave of dietitians joining all the teams, and that is candy. So they have they got like the full size Twix and stuff, like, sitting in the shelf that used to be everywhere. It disappeared in about 2018, but Toronto has held on. So, like, you can get and of course it's the Canadian version, where it's written in French and it tastes slightly different, and we don't know why, but it's delicious. Probably less sugar or weird chemicals that Americans put in everything. So that is one thing I look forward to. But there's always tons of snacks. There's so many options, but they're all options that are pretty much available everywhere. Just, they have all of them, because I think they take pride in that. So I thought that there would be some Canadian only stuff, you know, I don't know, like kokanee beer and for after the game or something, but no, Not really. It's pretty standardized, I think, through the league. But it is good. They have a lot of great options. It's just, you know, the Stinger waffles and all that kind of stuff is pretty much standard fare around the league now. We can blame the CBA for that.
Yeah, damn. I was thinking, yeah, you know, Coffee Crisp, I think you can only get here. There are a couple chip flavors or whatever. We'll have to put something together for you and send it your way, man.
Trevor, awesome.
Thank you so much for taking the time out, man. Keep up all the great work. Really appreciate this.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
That was our chat with Trevor May, who had a ERA under 4 in a bullpen last year. So yeah, I had to at least test the waters of any thought to returning to pitching. Doesn't sound like it. Love his work at Rates and Barrels, Foul Territory, May Contain Pod, and his own YouTube baseball play, Trevor May Baseball. So thank you to Trevor for coming on. Thanks to Hannah Kaiser of SMY and MLB Now. Thanks to Ben Nicholson-Smith, who did the hour with us, as always. Thank you to Amit Mon, Jennifer Rolnick, and Lance Kennedy behind the glass. It is Jose Berríos against Albert Suarez down at the Rogers Center tonight, 7:07 start. You can catch more of me on Blue Jays Central pregame, and we will be back with you at 10 a.m. tomorrow to tee up a 1 p.m. finale. Jays Orioles. Have a great Wednesday, everyone.